From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, after a wild stretch of politicking, Oakland County has itself a new executive to serve out the rest of L. Brooks Patterson's term.
It's all very, very convoluted and intertwined. It's been very interesting to watch.
Law enforcement balancing freedom of speech on the internet with preventing mass shootings.
And law enforcement, can't wait until the guy drives to El Paso and kills 20-some people. He posted just minutes before the attack.
Learning more about Michigan sand dunes and how to protect them.
I see signs frequently along the dunes that will say, please stay off this dune, help us protect it. And that's an interesting concept to me because I think, well, what does that mean, really? Protect what? Sand dunes move. That's what they do.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, a new study finds there's twice as much Michigan land covered in sand dunes than anyone previously thought. Later in the hour, we talk about what this means for shoreline conservation. But first, we begin with Oakland County politics. The Detroit News called it, I'm quoting here, ham-handed plotting. The Detroit Free Press declared the power struggle, and again I quote, could be set to the tune of Boots Randolph's madcap yakety sax. The two newspapers, often at ideological odds, were united in reviewing the political chaos that followed the death of longtime Oakland County executive L. Brooks Patterson. Today, Democrat Dave Coulter tendered his resignation as Ferndale's mayor, and a few hours later, he was sworn in as executive of Michigan's richest county. He will serve out the remainder of Patterson's term. Detroit Free Press reporter Kathy Gray is here with us now. Kathy, walk us through this political jockeying, when it began and who was involved.
Well, I got to tell you, the jockeying began months ago, even before Brooks died. When he announced that he had pancreatic cancer earlier this year, it became clear that he was not doing well, and there was a possibility that he might pass before his term was over. So the people started jockeying as soon as the announcement came about the pancreatic cancer. You've got Dave Woodward, who is the chairman of the Board of Commissioners. You've got Andy Meisner, who is the treasurer of Oakland County, and both of them would have liked to have been appointed county executive after Brooks Patterson died, if he died before the end of his term. There was lots of machinations about how this might happen, but it started happening a long time ago.
And surprising, because as you say, we knew back in the spring when Brooks Patterson announced that he had advanced cancer, you would have thought maybe things would have been a little more planned out, but it became a free-for-all, and not on the Democratic side alone. Some of the chaos came from the GOP side as well, didn't it?
Oh, my goodness, yes. County Commissioner Shelley Taub, when all of this started just falling apart, newspapers and TV stations and radio started filing FOIA requests for email traffic between all the different parties. And Commissioner Shelley Goodman Taub sent out an email that said, delete all of your emails because there was a FOIA coming. And so that was certainly added to the chaos. And I have to say, the chaos started almost 10 years ago when the county commissioners, the Republicans on the county commissioner and Brooks Patterson orchestrated a change in state law so they could continue to draw the maps that govern the county commission lines and change the way they did that. And so Oakland County is different than all 82 other counties. And so they were able to maintain their majority on the commission, which lasted until 2018 when the Democrats got an 11-10 majority on the board for the first time in more than 40 years.
And by golly, they were going to fight to keep that power tilted in their direction, at least for a while.
Absolutely. And the problem came in when Dave Woodward really wanted the appointment, and as chairman of the Oakland County Board of Commissioners, it was initially thought that he would have no problem getting that appointment, but he had to resign before he could be appointed as county executive, which left a 10-10 tie on the county board. And Woodward, to his credit, has some support from Republicans. They've had a pretty good working relationship on the Oakland County Board of Commissioners, but politics kind of reared its ugly head, and the Republicans decided that they could not in good conscience cross over and vote for Dave Woodward as the county executive. They decided that they had to stir the pot. Andy Meisner also, he didn't have the votes to get the appointment, so he wanted to make sure that Dave Woodward didn't get the appointment, so Dave Woodward wouldn't be seen as an incumbent when he ran for the seat in 2020. So it's all very, very convoluted and intertwined. It's been very interesting to watch.
And finally, Dave Coulter was sworn in today. Is that the end of things, or are the Republicans planning a court fight?
Well, the Republicans started a court fight even before he got the appointment. They filed in Oakland County Circuit Court. A judge ruled against them, saying that Dave Woodward could go back. Dave Woodward had resigned, decided that he didn't want to resign, so he went back to the board. The Republicans sued over that, and the Republicans lost at the first step. They may go back and appeal. I don't think this is over, but they made a good choice with Dave Coulter because he's pretty well liked by both Republicans and Democrats. He used to be a county commissioner, and he's now the mayor of Ferndale. He's going to give up that job, but he was pretty well liked when he was on the commission. So there may not be as much controversy once he's in place.
Detroit Free Press reporter Kathy Gray. Thanks so much, Kathy.
Sure. Thanks, Cindy.
Will marijuana tax revenues become the big aspirin pill that will cure Michigan's budget headaches? Well, a study out today from the Pew Charitable Trust might splash some cold water on that hope. Alex Zhang is a research officer at the Pew Charitable Trust. She's with us now. Medical marijuana sales, Alex, have been climbing steadily in Michigan, and boy, there's a lot of expectation. Once that market opens up for recreational pot, tax revenues are going to pour in. Your study looked at marijuana tax revenues in other states. What'd you find?
Well, one of the key takeaways we found is that the forecasting for recreational marijuana revenue is very challenging for states, especially in the first year of sales when markets are just ramping up because there's very limited data that forecasters can rely on and limited reliable data, especially for the two key components in forecasting revenue, which are consumer demand and product prices. And so these forecasting challenges have really made legalized retail marijuana a highly unpredictable revenue source. We like to caution policymakers in this case, most importantly, to be careful when using the revenue and budget the tax dollars in cautious ways, primarily to use it for things like one-time expenses or savings, which rainy day fund is an example of saving, mm-hmm. Instead of using the revenue for ongoing programs.
So looking at your study, I know you found, for example, Nevada tax revenues were 40% higher than state officials had expected over the first 6 months of legal weed sales. In California, the revenues were 45% lower than expected. So as you say, it's very hard to predict that, isn't it?
That's right. Revenue estimates have really varied across states, especially in that first year when there's the most uncertainty because there's just limited information available. Of course, states now, especially the early adopting states, have been gathering more information on things like consumer demand and prices. And so the reliability of revenue estimates will improve with more information.
Alex, how does state tax revenue from marijuana compare to revenue generated from those other so-called sin taxes, like on alcohol or cigarettes? Is there something we can learn by comparing them?
Yeah, that's a great question. Revenue from legalized recreational marijuana is quite similar to revenue from taxes on things like cigarettes and alcohol, which are also excise taxes. They have tended to take up a fairly small slice of state budgets. However, we emphasize that because all of these taxes rely heavily on consumer behavior, these revenue sources tend to be highly unpredictable, especially over the long term. And so legalized recreational marijuana especially is unpredictable because it has only been taxed and sold in states since 2014. And so lawmakers need to use all of these revenue sources in cautious ways because of this unpredictability.
Michigan set the lowest tax rate of the states that have legalized pot, a 10% excise tax. How do you see that impacting potential tax revenue? Does that help? Does it hurt?
Yeah, tax structure for legalized recreational marijuana can potentially affect consumer demand as well as how much revenue is generated from retail marijuana sales. Our research doesn't speak specifically to what type of taxes, how a tax can specifically affect sales and revenue. However, states need to keep in mind that prices can influence consumer demand for various products. Another consideration that many states have already observed is that taxes make prices on legal marijuana products higher, and those price differences between the legal market and the black market could influence how many users switch between the two.
Ah, there. Okay, got what you're saying. If it's too high, people, the black market starts looking better to people. You already alluded to what your study recommends states do with the money they make. Don't budget it till you've collected it and put it in a rainy day fund. Here in Michigan, though, they've already included projected revenue from marijuana excise taxes in the fiscal 2020 budget for using it for researching uses for medical marijuana, also money to communities allowing marijuana businesses, also some money for schools and for road repairs. Based on your study, did Michigan count those proverbial chickens before they were hatched?
Of course, it's at the lawmakers' discretion to use the revenue in whatever way they deem is appropriate. Our research doesn't touch upon how exactly lawmakers should use the revenue. We only caution states to consider the highly unpredictable nature of this new revenue source and be cautious that because given the uncertainty from year to year, that any program using these tax dollars may face a funding shortfall if the revenue doesn't come in as anticipated.
Alex Zeng is a research officer at the Pew Charitable Trust. Their study out today looking at revenue and use of revenue from marijuana sales. Thank you so much for being with us, Alex.
Thank you.
Coming up next on Stateside, this year's algal bloom on Lake Erie is shaping up to be one of the worst in recent years. We'll talk with a researcher at Ohio State about what they're doing to tackle this problem. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This year's toxic cyanobacteria bloom on Lake Erie is turning into one of the worst in recent years. Scientists say these blooms are caused in part by climate change, and we're going to see more of this around the world. While Ohio researchers are doing all they can to find solutions to this new normal, Chris Winslow is with us now via Skype. Chris directs the Ohio Sea Grant College Program at The Ohio State University and part of the Harmful Algal Bloom Research Initiative, HABRI. It's made up of more than 50 science teams. Chris, thinking back to 5 years ago and that big tap water mess and water restriction in Toledo, how does 2019 compare?
So the bloom has actually been larger this year, and the toxin levels that we're seeing within the Maumee Bay area where the intake is for Toledo is seeing, you know, the same numbers. So the toxic numbers are high. On the bright side, since HABRI, we've seen an uptick in the amount of research results that will inform water treatment operators. So we've given them a lot more tools, technology, and even early warning mechanisms so that even if the toxin levels in the bay were higher than they were in 2014, we do have the ability to properly treat the water so that it's safe for consumption.
So the idea is that yes, the toxins level may be higher, but you can do something about it that was not happening in 2014?
Exactly. So we've just got better dosing of chemicals that we know more about. One of the things that happened in 2014 is that the bloom went from not there to present very, very quickly. And then it also shifted from a bloom that wasn't producing toxins to one that did produce toxins very, very quickly. And so what ended up happening for us is that it just kind of took the water treatment plant by surprise. So now we have instruments and devices within the water column that tell the water treatment plant operators what's going on in near real time.
Walk us through what causes these algal blooms, these toxic blooms.
Yeah, so the organism is actually natural to the environment. So it's a native organism. It's called a cyanobacteria. The one in Lake Erie is primarily what's called Microcystis. And that organism likes warm temperature. It likes lots of light. And it likes nutrients. And so primarily what's driving this is that we're just seeing an influx in nutrients to the system relative to back in, say, the 80s and 90s. So we're seeing a lot more of what we call dissolved phosphorus. So phosphorus that's in the water that these organisms need to grow. So just like you and I, you know, we know what we need from iron and vitamin B and vitamin C to exist. Same thing is true for these cyanobacteria. But in freshwater lakes, Lake Erie specifically, the nutrient that's in shortest supply relative to what they need to grow is phosphorus. And so we've seen an uptick in phosphorus, and that's what's primarily driving this.
What are the main areas of research that Habry's been focusing on?
So four main focus areas that I would address. And the first one we've already really talked about. So the first goal back in 2015 when we started doing these research projects across the state was to give the tools, technology, and information that our water treatment facilities needed. The second major focus or thrust has been to look at the impacts on human health and even pet health. So we really wanted to know if you were exposed to these toxicants, what would happen to the human body? How much exposure would you need to have? That sort of thing. The third focus area was really in the area of bloom behavior. So we didn't really know as much as we wanted to know about when the bloom started and when it would stop and what triggered it from being non-toxic to toxic and when was the bloom all the way up at the surface of the water versus down at the bottom of the lake. Things like that are important because most of our intakes for our water treatment plants are at the bottom of the lake. And then the last area that we're focusing in, and I would say argue that this is where we're putting most of our effort now, is basically addressing nutrient inputs. So going up onto the landscape and trying to figure out how we can, number one, identify where the nutrients are coming from, but then number two, lessen that influence.
Speaking of reducing of nutrients, I have to ask, how involved is the farm industry in helping in tackling this problem?
They've been at the table quite regularly. So when we look at our data and we measure where the nutrients are coming from, so, you know, like wastewater treatment plants that are more an urban-suburban signal, that's only contributing about 9% of the phosphorus in the Maumee. We know that a little bit's coming from septic tanks. Maybe about 4% of the phosphorus is coming from failing septic systems. But a good estimate is probably somewhere between 80 and 85% of the nutrients are coming from ag-related practices. But to come back to your original question, what is the ag community or the farmers doing in this space? They recognize this. And clearly, this runoff is from mistakes of the past, not through malicious intent, but just things that they were told to do as a producer, you know, 30 or 40 years ago. And then they're really learning about what they can change now so that what they do in the present day, not, you know, the buildup from phosphorus from many years ago, but what they can do now to lessen their use of the nutrient, but also apply it in such a way that it stays on the fields longer.
I want to talk about human health, which is one of your thrusts. And certainly headlines burst this summer about dogs getting sick and even dying after swimming in water with blue-green algae. An algal bloom killed manatees in Florida. They've caused massive fish kills. What do we know about what can happen to humans from ingesting water tainted by cyanobacteria?
Yeah, so we know it's a liver toxin. So usually when you ingest something that's not supposed to be in your body, that's where it goes to be detoxified. So this is a liver toxin. We've seen some evidence that it can have an effect on the kidneys. We've also seen that if you have sensitive skin, it can cause dermatological issues, so rashes on the skin. But beyond that, we're digging in a little bit more. We're looking at lab animals that have pre-existing liver conditions and seeing if this toxin can be a carcinogen, so cause cancer. We're looking at things like what happens when people are on the beach or on a boat and they're breathing in water. Are they getting minute doses of this? And so we're looking at any of the impacts that might happen on the lungs. There's some early research out that we don't have findings on yet that's looking at folks that suffer from irritable bowel syndrome. And maybe does this exaggerate the symptoms associated with that? So I can say that there's a lot of early work going on in that human health space. But given the grant dollars that are in play, typically for these health studies, you know, these cancer-causing studies or these impact studies, you need millions and millions and millions of dollars. So what we would say is the work that we're doing right now is what we would call kind of the preliminary experiments, so that these scientists have initial data that they can use to go for larger grants through things like the National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation.
What is your level of confidence? When you think about this at night, at home, just turning this all over in your head, what's your level of confidence that, that you and other water researchers will find a definitive solution to algal blooms?
Oh, I'm extremely confident. I think, you know, we've done this before. Lake Erie was considered a dead lake in the late 60s, early 70s. It was even written in Dr. Seuss's book, The Lorax. And we found out that those algal blooms and those dead zones that were building up from that point in time were also driven by phosphorus, but they were driven by a point source, meaning they were coming from our wastewater treatment plants and they were coming from the phosphorus in detergents. So we put a ban on phosphorus in detergents and we invested a ton of money into those wastewater treatment plants to upgrade their ability to remove nitrogens. We pulled almost a third of all phosphorus out of the lake in the late 60s, early 70s, and the lake came back to its glory in the 80s and 90s. And so we've done a heavy lift like this before. We're calling for a 40% reduction now. You know, back 40 years ago, 50 years ago, this was a, you know, more of a third decrease in phosphorus. It's just a different source now. And unfortunately, when you think about wastewater treatment plants, you know where those facilities are and you can concentrate your investment there. When we think about, you know, 80-ish percent of the phosphorus coming from ag, basically, if you include all of Ohio, all of Michigan and Indiana, you're talking 7 million acres of land. And so it's just the lift is a little heavier this time around than it has been historically. But I'm really confident that we've got the right agencies at the table, the right academics at the table, and the right, you know, producer groups and suburban and urban residents to work towards an answer. This is a statewide effort, and there's a lot of universities at the table. We co-manage HAVRI with the University of Toledo, and it's been a great initiative.
Chris Winslow directs the Ohio Sea Grant College Program at The Ohio State University, a member of the Harmful Algal Bloom Research Initiative, HAVRI. Chris, thanks for sharing your work with us.
Absolutely.
Over the weekend, authorities said they had foiled three potential mass shootings, arresting three men in three states, men who had publicly expressed their desires to carry out mass shootings. There were Facebook posts from one, text messages from another, and a video posted to Instagram from the third. These cases echo a Michigan case from 1995 that became the first criminal prosecution of threats on the internet. The essential question is, where does freedom of speech end and when does it become a crime? Retired FBI agent Greg Stascoll was based in Ann Arbor and led the investigation into this landmark case. Greg, welcome back. It's so good to see you.
It's good to see you, Cindy.
So before we get into this case from 95, a little context about where we are right now with clear patterns in mass shootings in this country. Men.
Correct.
Misogyny, hatred of women, expressing thoughts of or actually committing violent acts against women.
At least in a lot of situations, yes.
Yes. And many mass shootings have been predated by some kind of internet postings from the shooter, like we recently saw in El Paso. And
yes.
Any other patterns that jump out?
Well, I think there's usually a history not only of misogyny, hatred of women, but also other aspects of violence, maybe some social ineptness, inability to get along with people, and they tend to be sort of lost souls.
You played a very key part in a case going back to the dawn of internet and email in 1995 involving a University of Michigan student. Tell us about this case.
It involved an individual whose birth name was Abraham Jacob Alhabitz, and he used the name Jake Baker. And Jake was posting stories on what at that time they called an alternative website, in this case, Alt Sex. And his stories were characterized as snuff stories. He characterized them that way, and generally that's what they were. And what they did is they involved kidnapping, torture, rape, and ultimately murder of young women in these stories. And they were quite lurid and quite graphic. The stories by themselves were obviously fiction, But that coupled with some other things caught our attention.
What other things?
Well, first of all, the stories came to the attention of a Michigan alum who happened to be in Russia at the time. And he saw, based on Jake's IP address, that he had some affiliation with the University of Michigan. So he alerted the university, who in turn alerted the Department of Public Safety. And they began an investigation. They were troubled by this and by the stories, but then they got a search warrant and looked at his emails. In his emails, and there were emails to several different people, but one in particular, a guy that identified himself as Arthur Gonda, who apparently was living in Canada, and they had these exchanges wherein they talked about the stories, but they also talked about actually wanting to do it, and Jake talking about different scenarios as to how they could do it, how they could kidnap women. In his case, he was living in East Quad, lived across the hall from a bathroom. And he said, you know, we could grab a girl late at night, knock her out, get her out of the dorm. He even said, I've explored looking for some secluded spots where we could, you know, torture and rape or whatever these women.
And you got pulled in then because the Washtenaw County prosecutor told campus police, we got no laws to do anything with this?
And that was probably true at the time. Mm-hmm. The federal government, of course, our criminal statutes did not address the internet, not yet anyway. Yeah. And this is 1995, and they didn't. But I went back and looked and saw that we did have a statute that I thought applied, and that is communicating threats via interstate or foreign commerce, which the internet is clearly interstate and foreign commerce, and he was, in my estimation, communicating threats.
With someone in mind. So you presented these in federal court in Detroit before Judge Aaron Cohn. How'd it go?
Well, first of all, I went to the U.S. attorney and got their authority to go forward, and we did, and I drafted a complaint and warrant, and we arrested Jake and took him in front of the U.S. magistrate for his initial arraignment. We did not ask for detention, but the magistrate was so troubled by the stuff that was in the affidavit and the stories and things that were attached that he decided on his own motion to detain Jake. Thereafter, the case was assigned to a U.S. District Court judge, that being Aaron Cohn, and it was clear that Aaron Cohn was not a big fan of this case. He's a big proponent of the First Amendment, which I understand. However, he ultimately ruled that, first of all, he told us when we do the indictment, we could not include the stories in the indictment because those were clearly protected by the First Amendment, which I'm not so sure I agree with. But at any rate, when we did the indictment, it only had the emails without the context of the stories, which actually mentioned an actual co-ed by name, her address, and in one case, her phone number. So without those stories, I felt the indictment was substantially weaker. But even with dropping the stories, Judge Cohn dismissed the indictment. And
Jake got out.
Jake got out.
What does this case show us about the difficulties that law enforcement today face in trying to figure out that borderline between free speech and a crime?
Well, and that is the problem. It's basically if threats are made and if they believe that they're within the protection of the First Amendment. And threats, the law is difficult. It kind of depends on how you're looking at it. And it has to be, I think, has to be looked at in context. But under common law, threats were what they call a general intent crime. That is, would a reasonable person believe that this is a threat? It's not the intent of the person making the threat. So by using that and going forward, we have to look and see, you know, how does this affect the community at large?
That old saying, your freedom of speech ends where my nose begins.
Yes, something like that. And clearly, in these most recent cases, at least law enforcement is opting to act proactively in the sense that they're saying, hey, we can't wait for these people to decide or if or when they're going to do it. Granted, there are a lot more threats out there than there are actual crimes. And law enforcement, you know, can't wait until the guy drives to El Paso and kills 20-some people. he posted just minutes before the attack. And as one of the things that I posit is, if that threat, if that shooting had not taken place, would that have been considered a threat by the courts? So we'll see what happens with some of these most recent cases where law enforcement did act and they were found to possess weapons, high-capacity magazines, in some cases white nationalist or Nazi propaganda, those kind of things. And also in the case of the Dayton shooter, where he had a history of misogyny, of clearly hatred of women.
So we shall see where these new three cases, how they're received by the judges, and if there's been anything that's changed since your case in 1995.
Yes, we will see.
Retired FBI agent Greg Staesgl, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Coming up, we'll learn all about a new study that found we've got twice as much dune land in our state than anyone previously thought. And the technology they use can pick up even the slightest changes in the sand. That is next, right here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan sand dunes are a cornerstone of the ecosystem in our state, and they've long been a big draw for tourism, as we hear in this 1950 MGM Travel Talk newsreel.
We are in the west central section of Michigan, where the Sleeping Bear sand dunes form a unique setting for Glen Lake, toward which the sands are creeping at the rate of 6 feet a year. This strange area extends for 5 miles along the coast, and it is said to be the world's largest moving sand dune. Boating, bathing, and fishing are popular diversions here. But for a most unusual thrill, we suggest a ride over the sand dunes in these so-called dunesmobiles, which are appropriately equipped with balloon tires and other accessories for desert travel.
Well, thanks to the work of Michigan State University researchers, it turns out we have a whole lot more sand dunes than anyone knew. Alan Arbogast is professor and chair of the Department of Geography at MSU. He and his team discovered Michigan may have more than twice as many sand dune acres as anyone previously thought, more than 230,000 acres. Alan Arbogast, welcome to Stateside.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So why are we only now getting a more complete picture of dunes in our state?
Well, because technology is better. It's actually what we've done is we are a first group to map the extent of the coastal dunes in Michigan in detail. There's always been sort of kind of a vague awareness of that there were a lot of dunes here. But what we did is we created a very detailed high-resolution map of the geography of Michigan's coastal sand dunes. And that's the first time that's been done.
And when you say some mapped in detail, how far back, like how early are the most reliable maps?
Well, it's kind of useful to talk about the history of this. Folks have been interested in Michigan sand dunes all the way back into the late 1800s. The first effort to map them in any kind of meaningful way was in the early 60s. And the people at that time, they didn't have digital technology or anything like that available to them. So what they did was they relied on what are referred to as county soil surveys, which are efforts by soil scientists to map certain types of soils, what kind of material they form in, and where they're located. And those things, while useful, those surveys are useful, they are kind of vague and oftentimes don't even agree between counties and the lines don't connect and things like that. So what the map was based on were descriptions of soils that were formed, quote, in dune sand. But that may not have been right. So that map was kind of vague, but it was a best effort at the time, and it was useful. In the 70s, as people became more environmentally aware of dunes and dune issues and development within them and sand mining and things like that, there was an effort to create the first classification system of Michigan's coastal dunes, which was in 1979, I believe. And that was a very solid effort to do that. There were dunes that were identified at that time as barrier dunes. Barrier dunes were, I guess you could think of those as being the largest. They were called barrier dunes because they formed a physical barrier between the beach and the lakeshore. And if you've been over on the dunes, you know that there are giant dunes that kind of get in the way.
Sure do.
Yep. And that was kind of what that was based on. So those were considered to be semi-permanent features that had a very clear boundary, and you could see those very clearly. Oh, there were also some, for lack of a better way of putting it, kind of boxed areas that were identified at that time that were called sand dune areas. And that's basically saying that, okay, we know that there are dunes within this box. Don't necessarily know the detail of that geography, but they are present within this area. And so there was an assumption and knowledge that there were more dunes than the so-called barrier dunes, but they weren't mapped in any kind of detail. In the late 80s, the Critical Dune Statute was established in Michigan. That was the first effort to provide some regulation on the development within dunes. And so-called critical dunes were identified. Those were dunes that were, on average, at least 20 feet high for a mile and a half at least of the shoreline. And or that might contain some so-called exemplary plant communities. And so there were about 70,000 acres of those sorts of dunes that were identified. At that time, there was aerial photographs that were available, some satellite remote sensing and whatnot, but the resolution was still kind of vague.
The technology was new.
That's right. Now we have high resolution, very high resolution satellite imagery called LIDAR, which is a radar image. And boy, you can see these dunes absolutely clearly. And so armed with that technology, we were able to look at the entire shore, both peninsulas, all sides. And so what we've done is that we've created this very first detailed map. And it so happens that it's about 230,000 acres, which is significantly more than the so-called critical dunes. Mm-hmm. We weren't really looking to make a comparison between critical dunes and just the comprehensive map, but it is something that is interesting to think about.
So, Alan, what is this LIDAR tool, this radar, able to let you do?
It just allows us to see the landscape in incredible detail. Down in the best imagery is sub-meter, which means that, you know, any bump on the ground that is smaller than, you know, it could be 50 centimeters, 2 feet, something like that, you can see it. And old remote sensed imagery, you know, a good resolution was 30 meters, which would, I mean, that's 90 feet, more or less. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine the difference. And it's kind of like seeing the dimples on a golf ball. You know, you're able to see it that clearly. And that technology just did not exist 15, 20 years ago. The resolution of LIDAR is getting better all the time. The satellite can see through clouds, so it's not dependent upon clear sky or otherwise, and it's just incredible. And, you know, I would, if folks in your listening audience want to have some fun, they can Google LIDAR imagery of dunes on Mars, radar imagery of dunes on Mars, and ours look exactly like what folks are living with on Mars. Of course, I meant that kiddingly, but it looks exactly the same.
Amazing. Actually, as you spoke, I did LIDAR images, Mars dunes, and there they are, clear as a bell. So
clear as a bell.
That's amazing.
You know what that means?
What's that mean?
That means that the wind is, that the, first of all, there's sand on Mars, and that wind is blowing it, just like it does here.
I'm talking with Alan Arbogast, who's professor and chair of the Department of Geography at Michigan State University. He and his team discovered Michigan may have more than twice as many sand dune acres as we previously thought. What have we been missing, Alan, by not knowing about these dunes?
Well, as a geographer, it's in my nature, and for others who think like me, to understand the true spatial distribution of phenomena, whether it's, you know, baby birth weights in Michigan or the extent of sand dunes along the Great Lakes coast. Much of the consideration of Michigan's sand dunes has been based, through time, has been based on this notion of what are the critical dunes. Again, these are the, I guess you could say, you know, the biggest, the best, the most extensive, right? And those are the dunes that that people think about most when it comes to regulation, what is being developed in there, you know, how they're being protected and whatnot. But there's a whole, there's even more dunes that exist within the state than those. My goal and my research through time has always been to, my hope is that folks at state level and, you know, in the lay public and people who visit and whatnot are thinking about the dunes for the way that they really are. And that may have some management implications later on. We know now that 54%, about that much of the overall dune landscape in Michigan is in public land. Some decisions can be made perhaps later on about whether that acreage should be increased or not. We now have a context to think about that in a very holistic way where that wasn't necessarily the case, at least at such a detailed level before.
And it's a good time to just ask you to explain to us just exactly what it is that makes the dunes so important. What do they do for our state? Clearly, people, you know, love to go to Sleeping Bear. They love to go to Saugatuck Dunes and climb on them. But take us beyond that.
Well, they're used in a lot of different ways. We know, for example, that there's approximately 9 million people that live in the state of Michigan. About a third of that number, or 3 million, go to the dunes every year. Now, it's not necessarily, 3 million of the people in Michigan, but there are that many visitors to the dunes. So clearly, it's a valuable resource in that regard. They are also mined in some places, both for foundry sand for primarily the car industry, and secondarily for fracking sand. And so they're used that way. And there are also favored places for people to build their homes and set cottages and things like that. First and foremost, it's a beautiful landscape. And it is really world class. I've taught a lot of classes in my time. I ask my students all the time who would like to go to Australia or New Zealand or the UK or places like that. Who would like to go see sand dunes in those places? Hands shoot up all over the place, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, who wouldn't want to go to those places?
Right.
I've seen dune fields in those places, and ours are just as nice. They're just as extensive and in some ways even more impressive than there. So I guess my message at a very simple level is you don't have to go to those places to see fantastic sand dunes and interact with them. You can do it right here in Michigan.
Do we have any reason to believe that we might see more sand mining? And if so, what effect would that have on the dunes and the areas around them?
That industry is pretty heavily regulated. There are always issues associated with that on both sides. People that live near a sand mine have strong feelings about it. And if you've been near one, you can imagine why. On the other hand, they've contributed a lot to the Michigan economy. The character of our sand, the dune sand in particular, is particularly well suited for industrial purposes. It's very well sorted. What that means is that all the grains are about the same size. It's clean. And so there's not a lot of dust that needs to be filtered from them. If you look at it solely from that perspective, it's an important resource. So I don't think there's any, from what I've heard anyway, I don't think there's any threat that there's going to be a sudden surge in the number of sand mines in the state. And trust me, there are a lot of folks watching that. On the other hand, the formation of them is an amazing thing. We've clarified that history over time. There was an assumption when I started here in 95 that the dunes had formed either right at the end of the last ice age, which was about 10,000 years ago. We've discovered that's not true. Also, or that they had formed pretty much in one shot about 5,000 years ago, and they've been modified sort of gradually or slowly ever since. In fact, we've discovered that it's a very complex history over the past 5,000 years, one that has distinct cycles to it. And so it's just an amazing place to work.
Ellen, what should we know about taking care of our dunes into the future?
That's an interesting question because it depends on who you're talking to. And taking care of the dunes is an emotional issue for a lot of people, and I understand why. If you believe and I mean that rhetorically, if you mean that, if you believe that dunes should be active and moving with lots of bare sand, then you take a position that we should do more to encourage that. Mm-hmm. If, on the other hand, dunes are, even if they're stabilized by forest or grass or whatnot, that there needs to be more acreage of that kind of landscape, then you take a different perspective. I see signs frequently along the dunes that will say, please protect, please stay off this dune, help us protect it. And that's an interesting concept to me because I think, well, what does that mean, really? Protect what? Sand dunes move. That's what they do by nature. And I think that those signs really mean, please protect the vegetation on the dunes, which is what's holding the dune together in that particular place. What I hope is to contribute something to that kind of a conversation as people try to decide in the next, you know, 50 years or whatever, what the dune landscape in Michigan is going to look like.
Alan Arbogast, who is professor and chair of the Department of Geography at MSU. We're going to dub you the Dune Hunter. Alan, thanks so much for being with us on Stateside.
Yeah, you bet. It was fun.
Burying trees and every unmoving object in their glacier-like path. And it is here that we now conclude our roaming in Michigan.
A new nonprofit is training everyday people to collect and identify fish in the Great Lakes. They think it could be a game changer for research in the region and even keep invasive species at bay. Interlochen Public Radio's Kayla Fond has more.
It's a perfect July day on this Lake Michigan beach, just south of Charlevoix.
It can be tough to hold them in place.
Stephen Hensler is calling out instructions to a group of people gathered around a cooler.
Count the rays on the anal fin, or check his ID, one or the other.
They're identifying and measuring one of the dozens of fish they caught that day by dragging a net called a seine for 50 feet along the shore. Hensler carries the tiny creature, a fish called a sand shiner, back out into the waves.
Okay, I'm going to release it.
He's the co-founder and executive director of the Cerulean Center, a nonprofit dedicated to Great Lakes research. Its stated mission is to, quote, advance understanding of the Great Lakes ecosystem. But more than that, the Cerulean Center aims to get the public involved in doing research. Like today, many of the people identifying, measuring, and counting fish aren't trained fish biologists. They're volunteers. But Hensler and his colleagues showed them what to do when they arrived on the beach today. And now, he jokes, the operation is basically running itself.
It's a good activity to do for people of all ages. I mean, it's pretty fun, and then it's a low barrier to entry, so.
Dale Treese is a retired nurse who lives just down the road in a town called Ellsworth. She's volunteering today, and she says she's loving it.
It amazes me how much these people that are teaching us know. They're, like, obviously fish doctors, and they're just, like, so friendly, and they're so informative, and you can ask any question, and they're going to answer it for you. It's amazing. It's amazing.
She says she learned how to identify fish and how to do it without harming them.
See how they're counting the fins. I see how they're measuring them. I see what kind of sampling they're taking, how we handle them with our wet hands and not dry hands. So I've learned an awful lot.
Seining fish today is part of a larger project for the Cerulean Center. Hensler says they're trying to get a better picture of the fish community in Grand Traverse Bay.
You can find things published about individual species or a few species at a time, but this we're actually trying to look at all the species together.
He says knowing more about what lives in the bay will help scientists detect any changes, as will having more private citizens on the lookout.
You know, we get a new non-native species, for example, we might have a chance of finding it and identifying it and reporting it before it has a chance to become invasive.
The Cerulean Center sampling project in Grand Traverse Bay will continue through 2020. For Stateside, I'm Kay LaFond.
Tomorrow on Stateside, a new rule by the Trump administration goes into effect this week. It restricts what healthcare providers who receive federal funds can say about abortion. We talk with the president of Planned Parenthood of Michigan tomorrow and learn what this means for the future of services and the people they work with. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.